So, thank you very much, Mike Moore, for sitting with us today. It's a pleasure to get to discuss with you. As we've discussed ahead of time, the purpose of this interview is to discuss mostly the period where replica symmetry breaking was formulated, which we've roughly bounded by 1975 to 1995. But to be able to talk about this, we first want to ask a few questions on background, if you allow us. And in particular, right, how did you get to be interested in physics and then to pursue a PhD in theoretical physics?
Well, that's such a long time ago in my case. I was an undergraduate student in Oxford, and I rather liked being there, and to do a PhD was an easy way of staying there. And they offered in those days very generous scholarships, so it wasn't a question of money. And I was useless at laboratory work, very clumsy. So I ended up doing theoretical physics. So that's how I ended up doing a PhD in theoretical physics. But I started out being a many-body physicist, as it was called in the 60s, where I was interested in problems like superfluid helium 4 and things of that nature. And only gradually did I move into sat-met situations like critical phenomena. So I became a postdoc in Urbana at the time when John Bardeen was there, and I was one of his 35 postdocs. He had two Nobel Prizes, and somehow when you get two Nobel Prizes, it seems to unlock the funder's purse strings. And I was just one of 35 people on his contract, and when I arrived there, I went to see the great man to ask him what he wanted me to do, and he was incredibly shy for a guy who was, at the time, I think he was also president of the APS, but he was just a very, very shy, quiet individual. I think he found it rather difficult at times. And he was so shy, he couldn't really bring himself to tell me what I should be doing. So he said, "Come back tomorrow." And I think I may have thought of something by then. And he came back. I went to see him the next day, and he said, "Why don't you work on showing that you can't have superconductivity at a temperature of more than 35 Kelvin?" And what he had in mind was fiddling with a formula called a Macmillan formula, so that I could get an upper bound on the transition temperature for superconductors. And well, that project really didn't go very far. And then I gradually drifted into critical phenomena. And then, having finished in Urbana, I ended up as a lecturer at the University of Sussex, where there was Tony Leggett. And shortly after I arrived, superfluid helium 3 was just discovered. And I sort of drifted into studying that. And no one knew what the pairing state was in the superfluid. Everyone hoped it was a P wave paired superfluid, and there was some evidence that it could be that. But there was meant to be a critical test of whether it was P wave pairing, and that involved measuring the neutron magnetic resonant frequencies at the so-called polycritical point, at which point all the many body nasty corrections would drop out, and you get an unambiguous test of the nature of the pairing state. So I worked, well, the experimental test was made, and unfortunately, what is now the accepted answer did not seem to be consistent with the experimental data. So people like David Merman and myself and others worked on alternatives, and I looked at the F-wave paired superfluid state. And it was horrible. The Landau-Ginzburg theory of that is horrible, just horrible. The order parameter has 42 components. And the Landau-Ginzburg quartic term, there are 14 different ones, all with unknown coefficients. And so one was trying to minimize the free energy and work out the NMR frequencies to see which fitted the data better than the P wave pair case. And having worked on this problem for 2 years and not found anything which really worked, it was discovered that this so-called crucial experiment had been done incorrectly. And it worked very well with what people had thought the superfluid state of helium-3 was all along. So as David Merman wrote to me, because everyone wrote in those days, well, there was no email. He said, well, we won't get our rewards on Earth for this, but perhaps in heaven we'll get it. But we'll see, of course. But I can't tell you if that is the case. So that's what I was doing. And I remember in about 1975, Mike Kostelitz came to Sussex. And I remember chatting to him after his seminar. And he was asking me this question. Two Hamiltonians on the board. One was the Edwards Anderson Hamiltonian. The other was the Mattis Hamiltonian. And he was asking me, why would the Edwards Anderson model be any better than the Mattis model? Or would it even be different? And I'd never seen either of these Hamiltonians before. So we had a sort of desultory conversation. But that was the first time I'd heard about spin glasses. And
Francesco?
So why the Hamiltonians were on the board then?
He was trying to interest me in this problem because back in Birmingham, he and Thallis had been worrying about spin glasses.
So he came to you and he wrote the... I didn't understand that. So he wrote the Hamiltonians on the board.
Yes, he just wrote them on the board. And you know how you chat after seminars. He was telling me about this problem by way of conversation. Now, if we'd worked at it harder, we might have discovered things like frustration and so on. But as I was hearing about spin glasses for the first time, I wasn't really highly motivated to spend a lot of time on it. And about that time, Tony Leggett was offered the job in Manchester, which had become vacant because Sam Edwards had moved to Cambridge. And I remember when he was offered the job, some of us took Tony to the pub one evening and gave him thousands of good reasons why he shouldn't leave and go to Manchester. And eventually he duly declined the offer of a job there. And the job was re-advertised and I applied for it and I was duly offered it. But I noticed my colleagues in Sussex did not really persuade me to stay. So there it is. And I went up to, I got the job offer to Manchester. But before I went up there, while I was still at Sussex, I had a message from Sam Edwards saying he would like to meet me. He was curious to know who had been appointed in his place. Now, I'd never met Sam until that moment. I was quite keen to meet him. And he invited me to his London club, the Athenaeum, which is one of these sort of dining clubs for lunch. And I went up on the train from Sussex to London, but it just so happened the French president, Giscard, chose that day to make a state visit to London, and that involved him flying into Gatwick Airport. And out of security consciousness, all the trains which went through Gatwick Airport were stopped. And so I was just stuck for an hour and a half, not moving on this train. And I missed my lunch appointment with Sam as a consequence. And in those days, without mobile phones, I couldn't communicate to Sam that I was going to be not there. So Sanvi arranged. And before then, it struck me that what could we talk about? And so I looked at his paper with Anderson on spin glasses. And that was really the first time I looked at a paper on spin glasses. And turned out I didn't have bothered because he just sort of gossiped at the lunch, and the spin glasses were never mentioned on that occasion. Though I remember over the years, I kept meeting him, you know, back in the 80s and the 90s, and he would shake his head about spin glasses. He says, oh, it's all got too complicated for people like myself. And it's a card I sometimes play myself these days as I've got older and older. I use that same line. I think I stole that from him. And but after that, when I moved to Manchester, Alan Bray was a professor, and he was appointed as a lecturer. And we worked on, we didn't work on spin glasses then. Worked on all sorts of things, critical phenomenon surfaces. I was working on polymers and things like that. And
so before we move there, if you allow us, so you've described a bit your how you got to be familiar with spin glasses, but how were you choosing problems at a time before you got to spin glasses?
Well, when I was at Sussex, there was myriad of problems in connection with superfluid helium-3, because it was only been discovered about 3 years, about 1973. And there was many, many things you could do. So it was an easy way to write papers. So any subject which is new provides lots and lots of opportunities. Whereas these days, I think in spin glasses, there are no easy papers left to write. All those have been written, alas.
So you were in 1976, you moved to Manchester.
Yeah, they wanted me, I think, to work on polymers because Sam Edwards had worked on polymers and I was in a sense his replacement. And as a consequence of that, I met the N goes to zero trick, which came on, of course, to be a big part in spin glasses. But that was the first time I'd come across that idea, though it was used for quite different purposes to do the disorder average in spin glasses. But even I was at Sussex for about 2 years before we moved on to working on spin glasses. And that was because in that period, I kept running across David Thouless. And he was very interested in this problem, which had come up in connection with the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model, namely that the entropy went negative at low temperatures. And Thouless's original hypothesis was that Sherrington had simply cocked up the calculation completely. But then he did the calculation himself and he discovered that it was perfectly okay, except for the assumption possibly of replica symmetry. And he wrote in, I think it was in a paper with Almeida, that maybe what one should do was to break the replica symmetry. And this seemed very hard to understand. How can you have replicas which are not the same? And so this seemed very, very hard concept to grasp. But Thouless himself didn't seem interested in breaking replica symmetry. And I remember him explaining that there must be an infinite number of ways to break replica symmetry. What are the chances that one would hit on the right scheme? You've got an N by N matrix. You can parameterize it in endless ways. Then you start fiddling with it. And what criteria would you use? Because in those days, We were never sure whether one should minimize the free energy or maximize the free energy. There was a lot of confusion on those points. And then later on, there emerged another criteria, namely that the saddle point solution should be a local minimum. But there could have been thousands and thousands of ways in which that could have been achieved. And I think Thales felt that it was just too much of a long shot to attempt to explicitly break replica symmetry. Anyway,
so in what context were you meeting Thales? In meetings or?
The theoretical physics community in the UK is kind of small. And when you have students, you need external examiners and so on. And I think I'd been the external examiner of Almeida. So that had taken me to Birmingham. But also, I think Thales had come up to Manchester and giving us a seminar. And I think I'd been down to Birmingham and given a seminar. In fact, I do remember going there. And in those days, Skirm of Skirmion fame was the organizer of the seminars. And when I got to Birmingham, I was a little bit early, and he was busily marking exam papers, and he had a huge stack of them in his on his desk. And he said, "Oh, these are very interesting exam papers. If you've got some time, would you mind marking some for me?" So I thought, I'll pass up this opportunity, thanks a lot. And so I had been down to Birmingham on a number of occasions. And but I think I recollect I was Almeida's PhD examiner. And at that stage, they'd done this complicated calculation where they discovered the Almeida-Thales instability line, upon which many of us have since worked since. And he was still interested in trying to go beyond that by breaking replica symmetry. So Alan Bray and I just, you know, we talked about this problem, we knew nothing at all about it, spin glasses really. And there were funny problems with spin glasses because they had no interesting experimental properties whatsoever. They had a kink in their susceptibility as a function of temperature, but that was it. Whereas, you know, when you have a superconductor or a superfluid, you get all these interesting experimental features. But in spin glasses, there's this kink in the susceptibility is a function of temperature, and that was it. Nothing else. And no one has ever discovered any particularly useful property of a spin glass. And in fact, this has been one of the problems with spin glass research over the years. It's only been the spin-offs from theoretical work which have been important. There's been no useful spin-offs from experimental work, I think, on spin glasses. And I recollect that one NSF program manager had realized how useless spin glasses were, and they have no technological significance. And he determined that on his watch, there would be no work funded on spin glasses. And that is why all the work which was done in the United States on spin glasses was done in Bell Labs and IBM, people like Fisher and Hughes and Scott Kirkpatrick and company. But universities couldn't really get in much on the act because you couldn't get an NSF grant to work on spin glasses. And this has been a long-standing problem.
So this was in the 70s.
Well, that was probably in the 80s when spinglass research was becoming a big activity, at least in Europe. And people in the States had trouble joining in because they couldn't get funding for it, I think, in that period. I mean, there may have been somebody who had funding from the NSF, but the ones I knew about were all in labs which didn't require NSF funding.
So before jumping to the 80s, like if you allow us to go back to some of the questions, right? Because 1977 was quite a seminal year for you, because first you started collaborating with Alan Bray. You also did Monte Carlo simulations, I think, for the first time. And that was your first work on spin glasses. So you told us about
work on Monte Carlo simulations as well. So we were in those days, one just looked up how to do it and did it. But now it's become rather professionalized. And there's all these tricks and so on. But we just bashed in and did it. And the big issue which came along was that Binder and Schroeder, Binder was the great man of numerical simulation. He'd done simulations of spin glasses, and he was pretty sure that there wasn't a phase transition in two dimensions, and he wasn't really confident that there was one in three dimensions, but it was unclear. And in those days, one didn't really know how to judge whether one had equilibrated the sample. And it was only in the 80s, I think, that Peter Young came along with an idea of convergence from above and convergence from below by studying using two different methods. And from that, you could tell whether you adequately equilibrated your system. In the early days, what you used to do was simply run for twice as long, and if nothing much changed, you said, oh, well, it's probably equilibrated. And we can realize in those days that you had to run for not just twice as long, but decades longer to be really sure that you had equilibrated the system. And that was always difficult. But of course, we were doing all this work in the era of punch cards, and missing right parentheses would set you back a whole day and so on. It was not an easy work time to do big, lengthy calculations.
So was that your first experience using computers at that point?
Oh, no. I was when I was at the University of Illinois, I used to do what were called high temperature series expansions, which were the only way in the 60s to get at critical exponents. And you got this series from which you could extrapolate to using, say, things like Paddy approximants to get estimates of critical exponents. And so you had to grind out the series for, say, the susceptibility of the Ising ferromagnet or the Heisenberg ferromagnet. And it was very, very boring. I mean, I did both the Heisenberg and the Ising ferromagnet to about 12th order in the Ising case, and the spin correlation functions. And it was terrible. I think you have to do something like 500,000 diagrams to do it. And I was using a mixture of hand calculators and an IBM 365, which was a fancy computer in those days. And my program ran to three boxes of cards. And I think each box held about 1,000 cards, and it was horrible. So I had done a lot of computing before the Monte Carlo simulation, but it was a different style of computing. It wasn't simulation. It was just using the computer to evaluate these lots and lots of diagrams. And in fact, while I was in Urbana, this young guy, he was older than me, but he seemed young, wrote to me saying, could he come through a banner and talk to me about series? He was generating series. And this young guy duly turned up, and it was Ken Wilson. And I became convinced this guy was a complete loser because he'd only got 8 terms in the series and I was up to 12. And every order required twice as much work than all the previous ones. And so my scorn was, I think, must have percolated through to Ken Wilson. So he decided probably that there must be a better way to proceed than grinding out these series. But we had kind of guessed from that work that there were universality classes and that Heisenberg was not the same as Ising. So things like that had been sort of deduced from this kind of new, series expansion work. And we'd even deduced that there was probably a phase transition in the two-dimensional XY model, but not in the two-dimensional Heisenberg model, which is still the belief. So they were not without their uses, but the effort involved in doing that work was awful. I mean, I would never go back to that kind of work. It was terrible. Yes. Oh. It was up there with doing a replica symmetry breaking calculation in terms of its ghastliness.
So you started doing Monte Carlo simulation. I read a review of a book that you wrote about Monte Carlo simulations 10 years later, in which you hinted that the books about Monte Carlo simulations are quite helpful because they avoid you making mistakes or at least learning on the rough, the difficulties. So what challenges did you meet when running those first simulations?
Well, I think the challenge which we had was that Binder seemed to always do it better. And we realized that we couldn't really compete with Binder. And so we decided we would do other things and that kind of numerical work. But I remember in those days that there was the guru of statistical physics was, and that was Michael Fisher. And he used to say you should only do numerical work when you knew the answer. And in the late 70s, we didn't really know whether there was a spin glass phase transition in 3 dimensions. Binder's simulational work was ambiguous on that point. There was the experimental work, but it seemed to indicate there was a phase transition, but it was perhaps not as sharp as what one was used to in other situations. And so it was very unclear whether one should even be expecting there to be a spin glass phase transition. And in fact, when Alan Bray and I did our first paper on spin glasses, what we did was we started out with the QQ field theory. And at mean field level, that is replica symmetric. And replica symmetry breaking was required when you went beyond the mean field level to remove the instabilities which came up. And we've had this replica symmetry breaking scheme, the two-group scheme, which led to the prediction that the lower critical dimension for spin glasses will be 4. And because there was an integral which diverged in 4 dimensions. Now, of course, we now know that if you actually do the same kind of calculation at Gaussian order for using more recent methods, using the propagators which Condor and De Dominici got for about the SK solution, they would also come up with a 1/k⁴ divergence, and you predict naively that 4 with a low critical dimension. Of course, there can be corrections which change that result. But so when Binder wasn't seeing that there was a phase transition and 4 was a potential lower critical dimension, we were left in a situation where we weren't really sure that the spin glass problem with its phase transition really was there. So we, it was very very confusing, actually. You know, what should be one's attitude to these calculations? But when we were doing our work in 78, Alan and I, we had no idea what we were doing. I don't know whether anybody had much idea, because we had no feeling for what different numbers of replica indices associated with correlations actually meant back in spin space. So we now know that if you repeat the replica index, it's like having two thermal averages and you're averaging over the disorder. All that stuff we just didn't know about. So it was just a game to us, which involving various propagators, and the fact that these things could have a physical significance just passed us by, because we were influenced, I think, by Thouless's idea that it was perhaps all too hard to get the right symmetry breaking scheme. We were just giving it a go to see what would turn up. And we never thought it would have any, we never thought it would be of any lasting significance, because it seemed just like a long shot. So we just bashed away, had this two group method of breaking replica symmetry, which just divided the replicas into two, M in one category, N minus M in the other. It seemed to be the simplest scheme one could think of. But much to our astonishment, one could get a stable solution as judged by no negative eigenvalues. And it wasn't until a few months later that we repeated the calculation using that replica symmetry breaking for the SK model. And we still didn't notice that the drawback of that scheme was that Z to the N, where Z's the partition function, was not one when you took N to zero. And we just hadn't noticed that. And it was Giorgio who noticed this drawback, because his scheme didn't suffer from it. And later on, it turned out that that number was equal to the number, the complexity associated with TAP, the TAP solutions. So before
we
were written on this rather.
Yeah, so before we move on, sure, to your complexity calculation. So in that 1978 paper, as you mentioned, there's a lot of references that are actually not real references. They're to be published, or if you look at the list of papers.
Yes.
So how was the information circulating between the community at that point? How were you aware of all those unpublished works?
Well, there were preprints which were circulated by mail from one group to another. I remember those from Saclay always came with a bright orange color, different institutions had different colors for the frontispiece of their preprints. And you could tell what was about, because everyone sent their papers to Michael Fisher, who once a month sent out a listing of all the papers he'd received. And if you thought some promising title was there, you could write to the authors and ask them to send you a copy of their work. So that's how things were done. But it was the invention of the archive was a fantastic step forward, because one of my jobs in Urbana was to sort out all the preprints they received, put them into filing cabinets, and then produce a list of what was there so everybody else could find them. And these filing cabinets quickly filled offices. It was so voluminous. It was so, the archive was just fantastic. It's well, I think it's one of the most important breakthroughs in communication ever.
So Okay, so you were reading those preprints and you were amused by the idea of breaking replica symmetry. At least that's how you've described
it. Well, it seemed like a contradiction in terms, replicas, but they're not the same. It just seemed amusing, as you say, that this could be a way to go. And we never took it seriously. For example, I remember we discovered these massless modes in our calculation. Massless modes, you know, the names like magnons, phonons, spinons. So what to call these modes? And we toyed with various things like muons, but we thought that would perhaps have the role of our overtones. So we call them replicons, but perhaps we should have chosen better. But that name seemed to stick in the community.
Were you aware that other groups were playing the same game at the same time, or that there was a race to the replica?
There's some work by Blandin, and which was, I think we'd heard about his work, and he had a quite different scheme, which I think was perhaps closer to that, to the one-step replica symmetry breaking scheme. Though I found his paper, but I eventually did see it, a bit hard to understand as to what he was actually doing. But I think it probably was what we would call a one-step replica symmetry breaking calculation. But most people were writing the papers, were writing papers where they did a replica symmetry breaking calculation and then finding various properties of that calculation. Nelson and Lundick they had a very nice paper where they developed the field theory of the Edwards Anderson Hamiltonian, and they put in all those full-forwarded terms which come up. That was a useful piece of work, which sort of influenced us a lot. The Edwards Anderson paper itself, though, was not much help, because there was a definition of an order parameter which was dynamical, which, as we were all doing equilibrium calculations, was of no help whatsoever. But it was a very ingenious idea. And later on, of course, one understood how to get at it. But at the time, the definition of the Edwards Anderson order parameter is the long time limit of SI of t to its value at SI of zero. It just seemed like an unnecessarily complicated way to go. We wanted a static definition. And of course, later on, it just became routine to how to do it. But at that time, their papers were not something which I spent much time studying, actually. So
one last question about your first RSB paper, right? In that text, you say that this is a first step towards a sensible mean field theory of spin glasses. But in our conversation, you've suggested that you didn't really, this was not necessarily a first step for you. Did you have a vision to go beyond?
Well, the first paper which appeared was a Fizrev letter, which was on the SK model. But the actual first paper which we wrote appeared later than the Fizrev letter, but it was actually written beforehand. And that was going to one loop order. And it was quite simple because we could throw out those horrible quartic terms. And so the mean field theory was perfectly, and the propagators had no nasty instabilities in them. And they only developed when you went to one loop order. But within the context of the cubic field theory, the calculations were very simple. If you kept in all the complications, which is what Almeida and Fowlis did, and if if you look at Almeida's thesis, I think he has something like 15 distinct eigenvalues in the full theory, whereas if you keep just the cubic field theory, there are only three eigenvalues, two of which are zero, well, one of which is zero, and two equal to two of those are the same. So it was very, very simple field theory. And that enabled us to go to one loop order without too much difficulty. And in fact, it was easier to do that than to do the mean field calculation involving the quartic terms, because life was just, it was just a simpler theory. So it was a good place to start. The curse of replica symmetry breaking only became apparent to us in the early 80s when we had, basically as a postdoc, though, because he was so old at the time, we had to pay him at a much higher rate. We had Imre Condor in Manchester. He'd already been working on this calculation on the Gaussian fluctuations about the Parisi mean field solution. And it was amazing to me. He had these huge sheets of computer printer paper, which came out in these big wide rolls. And what they would, he would do, it would write on these enormous pages, covering them with long, long formulae. And then he told me that one equation alone had taken something like 40 pages of this computer stuff to write down in its entirety. And it really impressed upon us that this replica symmetry breaking lock was just too complicated. I mean, you couldn't do Gaussian order without this pain. And in fact, that work wasn't published until about 1988. And it started on it in about 1980. And it was just so horrendously complicated. And I think that's been the curse of replica symmetry breaking ever since. The calculations are just horrible. Just algebraic, in principle, it's straightforward. But what you have to do is horrible. Now, since then, of course, people have found ways of simplifying these calculations, but they still remain, I think, to this day, horrible. And no one ever really goes beyond mean fields, the mean field approximation. To go beyond the mean field approximation is still, are still proven to be too challenging. So I guess it is, that is the way the field has stayed.
To get back to that, actually one of the first calculations, that of Giorgio Parisi, right, which followed closely, in time at least, your work. How did you become aware of it? And how did you react to it when you saw it?
Well, by then we had already had, we had written our paper on replica symmetry breaking, and Giorgio, I think he sent his papers to journals like JFIS-A and JFIS-C. Because we had written one paper on replica symmetry breaking, we were then obviously the experts on it. So all his papers were sent to me to referee. And in fact, they were coming at me thick and fast because of he was sending them to slightly different journals. And I remember having on my desk, I think, two of them at the same time. And in the second one, he'd already gone beyond the one-step replica symmetry breaking and was taking the limit. And I had this dilemma. Should I accept the first one, knowing that there was a much better one in the pipeline? And in the end, I thought, oh, God, might as well just accept the lot. But I wasn't that Well, interested really, because I was still under the influence of Thales's idea that no one would ever guess the right scheme. So I just put down what he was doing just as another long shot, which could be interesting, but is unlikely to be the correct answer, because there seem to be so many ways one could proceed why would that be the right one when it was really just a guess as to what one did.
So the fact
I
that...
I still find it's amazing that basically the second scheme on the market was the correct answer. For example, we tried other replica symmetry breaking schemes which never got published. Like, we published something called a two-group model, but clearly there's obviously a generalization, the three-group model, where you divide your replicas into three lots, and all that happens is the algebra goes up in complexity, but we didn't pursue, we never published that stuff, though. When I moved out of my office into another office, I discovered the old calculations, which filled a whole box file of stuff full of lots and lots of algebra, which the journals were spared because we couldn't bring ourselves to write up this stuff. I don't remember there was anything very interesting in it either. So there are many, many more schemes than perhaps being seen the light of day. But it looked as though Giorgio's scheme was the right one, so perhaps there's no need to worry about other possible schemes.
So it took some time
of course we know it's correct for the scheme model.
Sorry, so it was not Sorry. Obvious at the time. So how long did it take you or to sort of realize or to accept it as the valid solution to the SK model?
Well, I think by about 1981, when we were working on the complexity of the TAP solutions, we realized that the low-lying TAP states, which you had to treat in the complexity calculations by breaking replica symmetry. And if you broke replica symmetry using Giorgio's method, you got something which made a whole load of sense. And I remember we wrote some comment that the fact that these calculations seemed to be making sense had convinced us of the correctness of Giorgio's way of doing things. Because it seemed extraordinary that it could give these sensible answers were it not to be correct. And so if you use other approximations, the Dominici was calling the innocent replica approximation. It doesn't really matter what that was, but it gave stupid answers for the low-lying states, whereas Giorgio's method gave very sensible answers. And so by that time, I think we were convinced that it was the right way to go. I think Giorgio's scheme was developed quite quickly and was accepted very quickly as well. I don't think anyone was saying it wasn't the right solution, at least for the SK model, at almost any time. No one could think of anything negative in connection with it because it seemed to be stable. In fact, there was a very nice paper written by Thales, Kostelitz, and I think it was Almeida, where they did a limited calculation of the stability within certain sectors, the Hart sector, as it were, and they showed it was stable. A very nice but much neglected calculation. I say it's nice because it's easy to understand it, whereas the work of de Dominici and Condor was so complicated that it was just about impossible to follow it. Whereas this work, this paper of theirs, but that works like that, it convinced us that probably there was everything about the Parisi's solution was sensible. And we never doubted that it was the correct replica symmetry breaking scheme.
At the same time, you've mentioned a couple of times that you were working in a complexity calculation for the SK model, right? Which, you, if I understand well, this was the first complexity calculation to be done? Because you don't even use the word complexity at that point.
No, I thought the word was we were just computing the exponentially large number of solutions, the TAP equations. I don't know whether the word complexity first came to be used. There was an earlier paper by Edwards and somebody called, A. Tanaka. I don't know which Tanaka that was, where they'd done something similar. But they'd just done it, I think, at zero temperature, and they'd looked at the number of states where the spins were parallel to their local fields. But we generalized that to the TAP equations themselves. Which it provides more scope because Peter Young showed that the low-lying free energy solutions of the TAP equations probably correspond to the pure states of Parisi. So there was this connection there, which is nice, but of course makes the whole activity worth doing, I suppose, because if it wasn't like that, it probably wouldn't be worth doing. And we'd written a paper on solving the TAP equations numerically in about 1978, where we looked at the Hessian matrix associated with the TAP equation, and we discovered that the solutions which turned up all seemed to have massless modes, which pleased us a lot because we were big into these replicon modes, and we thought we were seeing the replicon modes in the TAP equations, which indeed that's what we were seeing. But later on, by 1981, we realized there were lots of other TAP solutions which didn't have massless modes. And in 2019, Timo Aspinall and I wrote a paper where we pointed out that if you solve your TAP equations by iteration, and that's the only way you can really solve them, you always ended up at the borderline between replica symmetric and broken replica symmetric states. And that is really the origin of these massless solutions, which you find in the explicit solutions of the TAP equations. And that's what I'm doing at the moment in this lockdown. I'm doing this long, long replica symmetry breaking calculation to do with complexity in the TAP equations. It's just horrible. I'd forgotten how horrible those things were, and it's coming all back. But now I've only got about 3 brain cells left. Whereas in my younger days, I could envisage doing it reliably. I'm no longer certain I can get these calculations correct.
So we will get later to your more recent work, but could you describe to us how exchange? So you've mentioned the preprints, but were there meetings in the late 70s, early 80s where those ideas were discussed that you attended that were particularly important? Or,
well, I can remember going to a Gordon conference, and I think it must have been about 1979, where there were talks on spin glasses, and I gave one of them. And the guy who gave the talk to me was that poor guy who he was killed in a road accident. I forget his name now. He was the guy who worked on stressors in glassy materials. Is it an Israeli guy? I forget his name now. Anyway, he gave the talk before mine, and it had baffled everyone. And when I started my talk, I said, at the end of this guy's talk, no one had a clue what he was on about. There was nobody asking a question. So when I started my talk, I simply said, I'd be talking about the spin glass problem, and I'd be showing there's an argument that the spin glass phase doesn't exist in three dimensions. And the audience just burst into applause at my opening sentence because they understood it. And it had this previous hour where they understood a word of what was being said. So there had been at least some Gordon conference. Then around 1980, maybe 81, there was a meeting in Aspen organized by Bert Halperin on spin glasses. And everyone seemed to be there. There was some Polinsky was there. I don't think Giorgio wasn't there. And I remember on the first day, Bert Halperin went around asking everyone what they'd been working on and what they were doing now. And then he talked to everybody. And then he announced that he talked to everyone, as a consequence of which he didn't think there was any point in having any seminars. They had nothing which impressed him. So we were completely free for the full 3 weeks just to work rather than listen to everyone giving seminars. I don't know whether anyone else has ever followed that method of organizing a workshop. It was quite enjoyable as a consequence.
Yes. In a note you sent us, you said that Alan Bray and you would regularly travel to Orsay to talk to various experimentalists in the field of spin glasses.
There was this organization called CECAM, which still exists. Its head was an American guy called Moser, who was very eccentric. In fact, he had an office in Orsay where he used to come in with his two pet dogs, which used to sit under his desk. And whenever you went into his office, they would growl at you. And you'd have to spend the next 10 minutes calming these creatures down. But he was the funder of our visits. And while we were in Orsay, we would go into Paris and talk to people like Gerard Toulouse and so on. And they were great. But then in the early 80s, we were very interested in the experimental side of spin glasses because we realized, and everyone realized, that the actual Ising Hamiltonian was not really a good description of any known spin glass. So if you take the canonical ones, say like manganese in copper, first of all, that's probably better approximated by a Heisenberg model. And there are other terms in the Heisenberg-Hamilton. There's a dipolar coupling term. There's something called the Dilashinsky-Maria interaction. And all that greatly complicated the effective Hamiltonian. And say one could write a paper just about every month where you put in one or two or others of these extra terms and worked out the consequences for, say, universality classes of these extra terms. And it was a sort of bit like the early days of critical phenomena with the epsilon expansion. There were lots of models to which you could turn the handle on and get out some results. And so one could go through the lots of simple calculations where you looked at the universality classes and so on for complicated spin glass Hamiltonians. And that's a kind of activity which has more or less disappeared. And so people these days, even though they're applying their results to canonical spin glasses like manganese and copper, they pretend it's an Ising spin glass. So in reality, that would be a very poor approximation. The excuse is that the small extra terms like the dipolar coupling and the Dushinsky-Maria interaction convert the effective Hamiltonian to an Ising Hamiltonian. But on what the length scales for that could be enormous, or quite large anyway. But that was quite a big activity then, trying to make, looking to what really went on in spin glasses, in real spin glasses. And I can remember looking at questions like magnetoresistance of spin glasses. And what changes to the magnetoresistance as you pass through the spin glass phase transition? Well, these days, I don't think people in the spin glass community would know what magnetoresistance even is. I mean, it's all that's a forgotten side of spin glasses. That's probably because there are very few experimentalists left in the field. But in the 80s, there were lots, and a lot of them were French, because there was people like Allul and Zazie Biel-Manot and people like her. They were, I guess, at Orsay. And it just seemed like another topic in experimental magnetism in those days. And conferences which one went to were often regular magnetism conferences rather than StatMech-orientated meetings, because there was a sufficiently large community interested in these disorder magnetic materials, actually doing experiments on them. But alas, well, I think people ran out of ideas for things to do experiments on. I think there's only perhaps what Ray Oback's group left doing experimental work to a large extent these days. And plus the group in Sweden, that's it, there's nobody else. Oh, well.
So one of the, I mean, beyond the more complex Hamiltonians, one of the very obvious experimental reality is the finite dimensional nature of the spin glass, right? And in the mid 80s, around the mid 80s.
Yes.
You published a series of a really seminal work on the finite dimensional behavior of spin glasses. What can you tell us about this research program and how these works came about and the resources you had at your disposal to carry them?
Well, I think what had influenced us was that to extend the Parisi replica symmetry breaking work down to three dimensions, it would involve going past this horrendous work which Imre Kondo and Cyrano de Dominici have been doing. And we just thought, oh no, I mean, that's going to be totally impossible to carry out. And so we were looking for other ways of proceeding. And one of the reasons we're interested in looking at the TAP equations is this: it seemed so much easier than replica symmetry breaking. I mean, the only trouble with the TAP equations is you have to solve them. But conceptually, it was all nice and simple. So you could write them down, and Flowers and Company had already done that. Solving them was a bit of a problem. In fact, it's one of my pet beefs is that very little effort has been devoted in, say, for the actual original TAP equations to how to actually solve these equations. Because people have found methods which work well above the Olmedo Thales line, but who cares about what goes on there? It's what happens below the Olmedo Thales line which interests people. And finding numerical solutions is just very, very difficult. Like, as you make the system larger and larger, it just gets harder and harder to get a solution. So anyway, it's conceptually simple. And we had this idea that sticking closer to magnetizations, MI, and avoiding the averaging might be the way to go. So the replica trick itself was the cause of all the grief which one had with broken replica symmetry. And perhaps it's going to be a lot simpler to not use the replica trick. And so we became interested in a paper, which I think began with some work of Macmillan in Urbana, where he'd had this renormalization group calculation, which is basically, I think, the Migdal-Kadanoff style of approximation, though. And we thought, wow, this is really simple. This is what we've been looking for. And because it clearly worked in two and three dimensions, and you could get results with very modest effort. And it was easier to do than simulations. It was certainly a lot easier than doing replica symmetry breaking calculations. And later on, in about 1986, Hughes and Fisher wrote their papers on the droplet model, which made the scheme, well, it got away from particular renormalization group calculations like Migdal-Kadanoff, and sort of provided a general framework for understanding what might come out of such calculations, but not tying them directly to any particular approximation. And that became, I guess, the droplet picture in the end. And it's seen, of course, that it was incompatible with the Parisi solution. And that's kept as busy ever since, in a way. And questions like, clearly, the Parisi solution is correct for the SK model, but as you move away from infinite dimensions, there are special dimensions at which you change over from replica symmetry breaking to the replica symmetry of the droplet picture. And then there's the other side, is the group in Rome had devoted a huge numerical effort with this Janus collaboration to actually showing that the replica symmetry breaking picture applies in all dimensions. And so there's all through the, in this century, that's been quite an activity. And people have just become exhausted with it now. I mean, I can barely bring myself to read any of the papers on this theme, but it's still an ongoing dispute.
To get back to the genesis of this, so how did you first become acquainted with the droplet scenario, the droplet model? You just read the paper, or was there?
Well, I think it was the work of Macmillan who kicked off the ball, and then we got into trying to improve upon his work and so on, and then there were papers by the paper by. I remember the paper of Fisher and Hughes, and we extended some of the calculations in that ourselves. And I wrote this review article, or we wrote this review article where, which appeared in the Heidelberg Proceedings of some conference, which was held there in about 76, no, 86.
86, yeah.
And unfortunately, it's my best cited paper, but it doesn't appear in the citation indices. Because it was published in Lecture Notes in Physics, which isn't a proper journal, and so it never gets picked up even though it's by far and away our best cited paper. So there's a warning there, never publish in something which isn't got the right ISBN number or something like that. Though in our library, the University of Manchester, the lecture notes in physics are just shelved amongst the journals. You wouldn't know it wasn't a proper journal from its appearance. But there you go.
So at that time, you also started working with Peter Young, right? It was your first collaborations with him. How did that come about? And
well, Peter Young was then in England. He hadn't yet gone to the States. And so the few of us who were working on these problems in England, we usually met in Paris at these meetings in Orsay. It was very enjoyable because Mike Kostlitz used to come as well. There were a whole load of us Brits coming over to Paris at the expense of CECAM to talk to French experimentalists. The local French theorists seemed to be too grand to talk to their local experimentalists. So I think the French experimentalists quite liked to have us talking to them. So that's how I think I met Peter. Though he and I had been students at the same time in Oxford, where we both worked on a model called the transverse Ising model, which is the quantum version of the Ising model, in which you put on a field in the X direction. And he'd worked on that problem and I'd worked on it as well as a model for ferroelectricity. And I wrote several papers on that in the late 60s. So we worked on the same sort of problem. So that's how I came to know Peter. But he was working on the TAP equations as well. And he'd worked with Cyrano. Their results seemed to contradict ours. And we wrote a paper where we understood how the results were both the same. They just looked different. So that was our first paper together. But then okay. Peter felt like the rest of us that all this stuff with replica circuit breaking was getting too complicated and that simulations might be the way to go. And he sort of went into that. And he made a great success of it all.
So could you tell us also a bit more about your collaboration with Alan Bray, right? It was very symbiotic in some ways, but what were the two of you, in what way were you complementary, or have you been complementary in working on those problems?
Well, Alan was a very, very good calculator. I mean, he was astonishingly reliable. He was a great person to collaborate with because he usually got things right, whereas it was more problematic if I did a piece of algebra, whether it would be right or not. So he was a great person to collaborate with. We're in this big department of about 80 academic staff, but we're basically the only two people with the same interests. So it was natural for us to collaborate. And when I'd gone there to Manchester as a professor, in those days, you were allowed to hire a junior person and he'd come as a lecturer, as the junior positions are called there. And so in a sense, it was natural that he should work with me, but he quickly became a professor himself. That's how we ended up collaborating. There was nobody else for us to talk to, basically. So we had to work together. We weren't spoiled for choice. There were other people around who we could talk to. There was nobody else around. And by that time, I guess the early 80s, Thouris had gone off to the States, Peter Young had gone off to the States. So it was, there were very few people left in the UK working on spin glasses. Sam Edwards had got other interests. He was at that stage saying it all got too complicated as spin glasses, and not he was no longer working on them. So it was he and I, Alan and I were the only two who could talk to each other. Alan was a great person to talk to. So it was fantastic.
So towards the late 80s, early 90s, you had a brief foray in neural networks, right? And you had a grad student who went on to be a professor in the field as well, quite a famous neuroscientist.
Yes, Neil. He became very interested in, well, he went to a university college and became a professor there. And he was one of these people who got into magnetic resonance imaging of what goes on in the brain. And so he's been doing that for a long time. But when he was a student of mine, we were much more modest in our aims. It was very hard to train neural nets to do anything. It was awful. And in fact, I was quite amazed that there'd been a resurgence of activity in the field of neural networks for applications. And with all this deep learning stuff and so on, because back in when we were trying to do this work, we could never train these networks to do anything. It just took enormous amounts of computer time. And in fact, we were trying to give the task was very simple. We imagine you were a child trying to learn a language, and what you hear, all these sounds, and you have to break them up into presumably smaller subsets, which become the words, and these words have meaning. So we thought we'd have a toy version of this problem where you just took out the spacing between the words and asked the neural network to break up this string of letters of the alphabet past it into words. Well, it'd be easy to do just by using a dictionary, that wasn't, presumably, I don't think the brain works like that. We just couldn't persuade the neural network to learn how to do it. But then we started collaborating with some people in the psychology department who described themselves as boxologists. And they believed in trying to understand the processes the brain has to go through in order to that certain tasks get carried out. For example, say you're playing tennis and you're receiving the serve. You know the ball's coming. You know it's going to be fast. So you have to see the ball, and the brain has to interpret what it's seeing to get you to move to the right position to make an appropriate response. So there's all these tasks which have to be sorted out before anything can happen. And these boxologists were all for drawing out lots of boxes which corresponded to different ways of processing the information. And Neil and those guys, they wrote a paper which attracted a huge amount of interest. Not on that particular, well, they were, that was influenced by that procedure, but they were trying to understand what's called the short-term verbal memory. And apparently, if you ask people to memorize a list of things, they keep muttering it to themselves. And they can remember lots of things if the tongue can easily go from one word to another. Certain words are easier to say next to each other than others. If the words are short, you can remember more of these words. And that example explains why the Chinese are very good at mental arithmetic. much better than, say, British people. And because the names of the numbers in China, in Chinese, they're small words, whereas the words are longer in English. And in Welsh, they've got very long names for the numbers. And Welsh people are supposed to be hopeless at mental arithmetic. And it's partly as a consequence that you can only have in your memory so many of these words. And you need to have them in your memory to do mental arithmetic. And they built a model of how this worked. And they got a prize for the best paper in the field of psychology in the years 1991 to 1993 or something like that. And it was very, very nice paper. But I thought this was incredibly dodgy stuff because my name was Lutherby because I kept my away from it because I thought it was so speculative. But they just believed that there were boxes which would correspond to these various processes, even though what was in the box and where the boxes were had not been identified. So
in that context, so you worked for a couple of years on neural networks, and I understand better the context now. But you quickly left also the field, unlike many of the people who had worked on replica symmetry breaking, who moved on permanently in some ways to neuroscience. So was this related to your skepticism with respect to some of the neuroscientists practicing?
Well, partly. We failed to make a success of teaching neural networks to do tasks. Because when you used to go to meetings on neural networks, people would say to each other, what we want is a killer application which will really bring people into the field. And none seemed to be forthcoming at the time. And in fact, it wasn't until later on, I think it was DeepMind, and they developed these programs which you could play Go and so on. The whole field took off, as it were, where you could teach a system to learn how to do tasks well. But in the 90s, and that such examples were not available. And so we had the ambition, but we didn't have the right computers actually to carry out the ambition. So
You also left the field of spin glasses for nearly a decade at that point.
Yes, I remember I didn't do anything. I went into sort of high temperature superconductivity and things like that. But I remember coming to a meeting again in Paris. Everything seems to have happened in Paris, as far as I can tell. There was a meeting on StatMech in about 97 in Paris. And I bumped into Imre Kondal. And he said to me, "See, it was a shame the droplet model turned out to be wrong." I said, "What?" It was news to me that this was the case. So I thought I'd better look up what had been going on in the years we've been away from the subject. And then I got back into it with trying to understand how it is that the simulations could seem to support the existence of replica symmetry breaking, but still fundamentally the system had the droplet replica symmetry features. So that is what it was only Imre's remark that the droplet model, alas, had died that got me back into the field. I'd passed that, I just hadn't been reading the papers, which had led him to come to that conclusion. So, yeah.
And you've mentioned early on, right, you've kept on toiling in the field ever since. Including in retirement.
Yes.
So what do you find so compelling about this problem that keeps you active?
Well, it's I don't think it's been resolved satisfactorily. But it has the advantages for an old codger like myself, in that You don't have to learn anything really new. The issue is, which is the correct way of looking at spin glasses? Is it the Doppler picture or its cousins like the Newman and Stein variants and so on? Or is it a broken replica symmetry picture with its hierarchy of states and all that kind of thing? And it's a well-posed question, and one would like to know the answer. And as there have been many attempts to sort it out, but you haven't satisfactorily resolved the matter to everyone's satisfaction anyway. It's a topic which keeps on giving, though to do actual calculations gets harder and harder and harder, because all the things which are easy to do with this matter have already been done. So, but hopefully there'll be, I'm not actually doing this at the moment. I've gone back to straightforward SK model and mean field calculations. It's a sort of holiday from that topic, but it's still what I would like to be working on. I could think of something new to do in that connection. But it's always been a matter of some disappointment to me that the rigorous results guys have never managed to satisfactorily resolve the issue as to the nature of the order parameter in spin glasses. You think they would have been able to sort that problem out, but unfortunately they have yet to do it. So, I mean, if people thought they could do it, I think Newman and Stein had that ambition, but they just leave open the question. The rigorous results admit both the possibility of a droplet-like picture and also the replica symmetry-like features. So rigorous results so far have not yet resolved the matter. It's an ongoing problem, I believe.
Yes. In all your years as lecturer or as teacher in Manchester, did you ever get to teach a class on replica symmetry breaking and spin glasses?
No. We the closest I came to that, we used to have a graduate course on statistical physics. And I remember talking about replica symmetry and things like that on that course. But never at undergraduate level. I don't think they would take it. These are people who paid good money. They're not going to be fobbed off with stuff like that, I don't think. Keep on paying.
Yeah. So how did your students learn? Or did any of your students learn?
I don't think we've ever been cruel enough to give any student a replica symmetry breaking calculation. Okay. So we've had students do calculation where you had to use replicas. For example, I think the most famous one is Roberts, who worked with Alan Bray, the Bray-Roberts calculation for the critical exponents across the Almeida-Thouless line. And in those days, in the 80s, early 80s, first-year graduate students were meant to do a calculation for a report which they had to write at the end of the first year. And this was Roberts's report, was a Bray-Roberts paper. But so Alan had never done the calculation himself. They didn't find a fixed point. He felt there should be a fixed point, but he thought maybe Roberts had messed it up. But it was quite fiddly to check. It was you had to be very careful with all those replica summations to get the answer. So he never checked it. And I used to come across Alan musing from time to time, if you change this 18 to a 16, then there would be a fixed point in these equations. And that calculation has been checked by lots of people, including, I guess, by implication yourself, Patrick. But yeah, so, but that's about the clue. We didn't just like to give students these replica calculations because it was very, very hard work for them to do. And then, of course, later on came the P-spin type of model, which we missed out on, basically, but got into it later. But everybody else had just had moved on. But I came to it late with in some papers with Junio. And I guess another ongoing activity. It's always puzzled me, actually, as to the attitude of the community towards these P-spin models, because they are the background for the RFOT theory, which is, of course, still a very active theory. Yet if you look at real P-spin models using simulations, the results of those simulations are absolutely nothing like the mean field theory. And Parisi and others wrote papers pointing this out in the, well, about 2012, the whole flurry of papers. And Silvio Franz wrote some of them. And it's just incredibly different. So the fluctuations about the mean field theory are enormous. And they transform what happens from the well-understood mean field results to something which is not well-understood. But oddly enough, no one works on this problem to a good approximation. What happens in three dimensions to these models, which at mean field level are the basis for the RFOT theory? And I'm just amazed that there's so little activity on that topic. But then when June and I tried to do some work on this, that's something I'm doing now. It turns out to be very, very hard work also. There's no easy calculations left. But that's another activity which we're pursuing at the moment.
Francesco, I wanted to give you the chance. Do you have questions you wanted to ask? No. So we're coming to a close, but we want to make sure, did we miss anything important, right? It's very possible we did. So is there something else we should know that you would like to share with us?
Well, I think I mentioned this in the email which I sent to you. When everyone had lost interest in whether the Parisi scheme was correct, and everyone agreed it was, we discovered that the actual Parisi symmetry breaking scheme was not completely correct. And we noticed this when we tried to go beyond the thermodynamic limits for the SK model and compute the finite size corrections to the SK model. There you have to keep little n in the problem rather than just take it simply to zero. And when you keep little n in the problem, you realize that the Parisi solution just makes no sense. So Timo Aspel and I wrote this paper where we had to generalize the Parisi scheme. So basically, the Parisi scheme became just one of the blocks. So you had an infinite number of blocks inside of which the symmetry was broken according to the Parisi scheme. And that got rid of all the problems with taking the n goes to zero limit. And you could compute the finite size corrections. But later on, Cyrano de Dominici and Di Francesco, they showed that you could keep the original Parisi scheme, provided you put restrictions on the form of the blocks, which weren't in the original Parisi scheme. So there have been sort of effects which were overlooked in the original scheme, which I presume have now been resolved. But because there's been very little follow-up work, because these finite size corrections are just as hard to get at in a way as doing three dimensions, it's nearly as challenging. There hasn't been much work, but it's curious to know that the Thouris's original pessimism about getting the scheme right is in fact borne out, because no one doubts the in the thermodynamic that the Parisi scheme is correct, but as it was formulated and stood for years, it is not, we believe anyway, fully correct. And whether there's going to be other developments along those lines, I don't know.
So, thank you. I
think that also Bernard Derrida has been working on this same problem, right, of computing finite size corrections.
In the Grimm and the Rem. And
blocks, the fluctuating blocks and things like
yes,
that.
Yes, yes, yeah, yes.
So did you discuss with him?
Yes, but the difficulty is that he doesn't use replicas. He has some other technique, which is probably a good thing. That's why he's making progress. But to map what he does back into the language of replicas, he told me he was hoping at some stage to perhaps think about, but it hasn't yet, I think, been done.
Thank you.
So in closing, have you kept any notes, correspondence, and the like from that epoch over the years? And if yes, do you have any plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
Well, there are one or two bits of correspondence from famous people over the years, which I think I'm able to dig up copies of. I'm happy to deposit them. I remember getting a letter from Anderson where he accused Alan Bray and I of deliberately misunderstanding his paper with John Hertz. And curiously enough, we had a letter from John Hertz saying only when he saw our paper did he understand his own paper with Anderson. So different interpretations of our work. So it was quite an amusing letter from Anderson I've never been accused of deliberately misunderstanding. I've often failed to understand it. And then I had another interesting letter from Mandelbrot, who acknowledged that I'd cited his work quite correctly, but he was complaining that I hadn't used sufficient enthusiasm in citing his work. So he wanted words like in the groundbreaking study of ... I had missed out the words like in the groundbreaking study. So I don't think this is really adding much to the sum of human knowledge, this kind of letters from the great men of the subject. But it certainly amused us at the time.
So you have a few examples, a few items, but not the, you've not kept extensive notes?
No, because once email came along, letters began to fade out. I can remember being at Santa Barbara in about 1980 something or other, when there was a guy who we'd gone to lunch with, and he said, after lunch, I'm going to go back to my office and I'm going to send it an email. And we all said, well, what's an email? And come and watch. And so we all went along and watched him send an email, and we all fell over laughing. Why don't you just pick up the phone and talk to the guy? Little did we realize we'd spend half our lives doing email. So it didn't change anything. And all my emails before the year 2002 were lost when the computer where they used to be stored was removed. And somehow I never bothered to transfer them to the new setup. So they don't last forever unless you take special measures to keep them, actually. So you think at the time it doesn't matter. But only later on you regret that you didn't bother. Because one's got so much of this stuff, most of it's complete dross, that it's hard to pick out the stuff which would be of interest to anybody interested about this stuff in the future. Because the truth of the matter is, in the future, no one will care about any of this stuff. But I guess when you're making an archive, you don't like to think about that feature of things, because you hope that people will consult these things in the future. So it's, yeah, I think, I mean, the evidence is that it's in the long run, everything is forgotten.
I nonetheless encourage you to consider if you, I mean, at least talking to the University of Manchester. I don't know if they have a program for archiving faculty papers.
And well, I'm, for my sins, I'm a fellow of the Royal Society. And they encourage you to deposit stuff in their archive. And that's okay. What I would probably do if I could find suitable things. And yes, actually, these COVID-ridden times, it might be a good idea for me to hurry up with these things, because you never know when the infection might strike these days. So perhaps I should get on with doing this kind of stuff.
Mike, thank you so much for your time. It's been an extremely interesting and amusing conversation as well to have.
Okay, well, I hope it's been of some use to you. So will it be generally...
So let me just...